I'm Peter Medlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge. And if this is your first time hearing our show, I've got great news. It's based on a really simple idea. We've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every educator we have on this podcast, whether teacher or coach or professor, is nominated by the folks who listen. We want you to be a part of this show with us, so please tell us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations at teacherslounge@niu.edu. Now, today on the show, we've got something a little bit different for you. It's my conversation with Ed Hajim. Ed's the former chairman of the board at the University of Rochester in New York, and he's also a retired Wall Street executive. Now, Ed had an extremely challenging childhood. At 3 years old, he was kidnapped by his father, driven across the country, and left for years in an orphanage. So with the cards he was dealt, he had to figure out what the heck he was going to do with his life. What did he care about? What did he want? How could he get there? And who could help? And now, Ed wants to help other people, particularly students, figure out who they are and how to make plans in a world that feels like it's changing faster than ever. That's why he wrote his book, Island of the Four P's.
There's only two constants in the world, not death and taxes. It's ridiculous. Taxes are not incurred until, you know, 20s, and death only happens once. There are two constants. One is your inner voice and change. And what I'm trying to do with this simple process is create a very simple vocabulary for your inner voice so you can talk to yourself.
Island of the Four P's is written as a fable, as a sort of hero's journey across an island where the trials are designed to help you understand yourself and where you're led by a guide who's trying to help you become your own guide. So my conversation with Ed is coming up, but first, we've got another education story we want to share. The Trump administration is revoking the visas of international students across the country, often with little or no reason offered as to why. That now includes students at Northern Illinois University, and I got to speak with a few international students on campus who are feeling really anxious. The news just broke as I drove to campus.
Five international students at Northern Illinois University have had their visas revoked.
It's so recent that several of the international students I meet with don't even know yet.
Just hearing this.
Really?
I don't know if you guys had...
No, this is my first time hearing this.
This is the first time we know, and
now
you have... Yeah, so I'm so surprised.
They're all graduate students, originally hailing from different parts of Asia and Africa. They requested anonymity because they're scared the Trump administration will revoke their visas for speaking out against its policies.
What are we supposed to do as graduate students? You know, we come from different countries. We start everything from scratch. We're paying our tuitions on time. You know, there's all these things we're doing correctly. What more are we supposed to do? Like, I heard that they are revoking visas for having parking tickets, which is insane.
Several students said those NIU students weren't told why their visas were being revoked. An NIU spokesperson says the university communicated directly with each student the reason for the visa revoking listed in the government-managed system, but if the reason is vague or unclear, NIU doesn't have a way of knowing anything beyond what's listed. Either way, the students say it feels like the Trump administration is inventing reasons to target them. They used to feel safe on campus, but...
Not anymore. Not after this morning, so I'm just guessing everything I do now. I'm like, should I do this or should I not? Should I buy Asian groceries? You know.
They're scared to speak out. They're scared of traveling, of posting on social media, or yes, even going to an Asian or African grocery store in fear of being pulled into a car by federal agents like Tufts University student Rumeysa Ozturk.
A few days back, I think being extra cautious was good, but now I'm being extra scared, actually.
Yeah.
One student is traveling domestically soon and is a little concerned about an essay they wrote several years ago criticizing the Trump administration's immigration policies.
This is from 3 years ago. And I'm like, oh, I've had to consider, well, do I probably should delete it from my computer or save it on the cloud or something in case I come into contact with immigration agents.
Some of the students are just weeks away from getting their diploma, but now they're not sure they'll be able to graduate. Maybe they'll get deported first and saddled with a student debt. They say it's extremely disheartening knowing how hard they worked to get here, from the exams, the visa interview, the statement of purpose convincing the university they're worth bringing, and finally the pressure to be the best in your classes.
we are actually paying almost three times the tuition that a normal in-state student would pay for a graduate student. And if you check the stats, we are on top of all our classes in most cases. We are, you know, we're adding to the economy a lot. I don't see how we are the problem here.
Their families back home are freaked out too. For some, it's changed their perception of America. They were raised on the idea of a land of opportunity and free expression for all.
The place I come from, we were in our constitution inspired fundamental rights from USA. We got it into our constitution from them, but I don't think it is like uphill that much because we're like boasting about the right to
freedom of speech
and all those stuff. But
is there like, freedom of speech? There is no freedom of speech.
So that is a question here.
A few weeks ago, NIU President Lisa Freeman issued a statement saying that international students are a valued part of the community. But these students say they want the university to be more clear about how they can support them and what their options actually are.
How does that support actually materialize when the going gets tough? I have no idea.
WNIJ requested an interview with the university's International Student and Scholar Services, but they declined. Amid it all, it's been hard to keep their head down and focus on their studies. But they say they have to persist.
Choosing to remain positive. I'm doing everything within my power to be a law-abiding alien, as they say, law-abiding international student.
Several of the students still want to stay and build a life here in the U.S. They say they've done everything right. They love their friends and their community. They're excited about their future in America. But they say it's feeling more and more like they're not wanted, like they're being shoved out the door by any means necessary. The Department of Homeland Security has also been terminating student service records, and that now includes three students at Augustana College in Rock Island. All right, now it's time for my conversation with Ed Hageum about his book, Island of the Four Ps. And we'll learn about what exactly the four Ps are, how this can help students make hard decisions, and so much more. But we start off talking about why he really wanted to write this as a fable in the first place.
The fable essentially traps you into doing your own thinking. You know, if you have a how-to book, people say, don't tell me how to do it. But in a fable, you're actually acting as that character wandering, in this case, through these four villages. Even the old man who's with the young man and the young lady, he isn't a teacher, he's a guide. He's guiding this person to get his or her own answers. And I found that I'm very concerned about Gen Z and young people at this point in time because they have a much more complex experience, a lot more opportunities, more complex. And I think they need a simple vocabulary to help them make decisions that they can start testing things earlier in their life. And I think that's something that I did successfully and found out, you know, what I really want to do with my life. And I think that this is the case most people. And I have a course now from the book, which I'm starting to put forth. I have five institutions already using it, basically with eight sessions that go through the four Ps and other parts of the book that basically allows the student to formally think about who he is or who she is, where they want to go, how they expect to get there, and maybe why they're going there. And then essentially graduating with a diploma and a life design, written in pencil, because it has to change.
Yeah, let's outline what the four Ps are up front.
It's basically find your passions, and passion's an overused word, but it's your interests, your likes, your dislikes, your strengths, your weaknesses, and also your context. Your passions are different in New York City than they are in Kiev or Toronto. You have a different context. So each person has a different context. So find your passions, what you really want to do, what gets you excited, and see whether you can pursue those. You may have to delay them for a while, but understand what they are. Then find your principles, principles go way back to do unto others, but there are other principles. In my life, I had a principle basically that said, if I didn't worry about who got the credit, I really was successful. And then I sort of deflect credit. Going back to passions, in fact, my passion I found in college, which was to basically help people do better than they thought they could. Then the principle involved here helped me carry out that passion by not worrying about who got the credit. In fact, later in my life, I deflected credit. And then you find out my biggest principle is gratitude. So I'm thankful for everything that I have. So then find your partners. I found out that, that's a very important P. I was only good as the people I surrounded myself with, starting with P1, partner one is the most important decision you'll make, even more as important as your passions. Finding someone you can share your life with, someone who'll support you and you can support. And I've been married for 60 years almost. This year will be 60 years. So I find if I didn't have her, I wouldn't be here today. She's helped me make decisions and carried out all the facets of my life. Then finally, when you find your first three P's, take those and put them into plans, written plans. And so you can look down and say, this is what I think I want to do. And in my book, I lay out ways of determining the plans. But I really want to create an additional dimension for college education or high school education. There are two schools now, one at each end of the spectrum. One is a first-gen school. Another one's a very prominent private school are pursuing this for their students. I'm seeing whether it actually can be done for high school students, seniors in high school. One of the schools says, this is going to be a required course for our seniors. And I think that's important because they graduate with thinking about the kinds of things they want to test in the next 4 or 5 years. And I can go through that with you if you'd like.
I think it's interesting. I was thinking about my own school experience and how we're prepared or maybe not as prepared to make these plans and even to explore these passions, right? Like people feel very stressed out at that point of their life, particularly. Obviously, people are, like you said, people pivot a lot in their lives and, you know, change different careers, change passions. But particularly when people are at the school age, they feel like they're under a lot of duress to make these decisions. And so that's a difficult environment to be open to exploring passions, exploring new ideas, exploring what your principles are. And I was one of those people that I got into community college and I really didn't know what my Monday morning was going to be. I, you know, had a somewhat decent idea about some of the things I excelled in, but I didn't know how that was going to translate. And I took at like one of those like career exploration courses.
Yeah.
And I found that all that it really was is they had me take a couple like personality tests where it was like, you're actually an AEG or it was like some series of numbers that really didn't mean it or letters that didn't really mean anything to me. Didn't find it to be practical at all. And what I actually found helped was that the career exploration was actually just taking courses and exploring and figuring out the things that I was passionate about.
I want to give you a step, get you a step ahead. And it was in your freshman year, if you were pressed to, you know, to say, what are the things I really want to do? What excites me? And by the way, you're in a classroom with, let's say you're in a section with 8 or 9 other young people, and they start talking about their passions, which also might say, yeah, that's me too. Or you're not alone in the situation, in other words. And others would tell you how they've been exploring. And then you go through this process of saying, what are my passions? And then sort of look at all the different things that you're really interested in. And then you say, okay, now these are things I want to test. And if you basically probably got ahead, you may have saved yourself a year or two by picking out certain things to test earlier. Because you did this informally. You did it in the dining room or in the, you know, in the dormitory or even, you know, talking to yourself. See, what I'm trying to give you is a vocabulary for that inner voice. There's only two constants in the world, not death and taxes. It's ridiculous. Taxes are not incurred until, you know, 20s and death only happens once. There are two constants. One is your inner voice and change. And what I'm trying to do with this simple process, these 8 words, mainly 4 words, is create a very simple vocabulary for your inner voice so you can talk to yourself. You say, you know, here's my passions. What am I doing to test them? So one of my keys is never waste a summer, you know. And people say to me, why do you recommend graduate school? I say, well, I recommend graduate school because it gives you a chance to look at the world one more time. Second thing it does it basically says, you know, I got a whole new group of friends, you know, which are going to last a lifetime. The third thing nobody recognizes, you get 3 more summers, you know, where you can fool around and test things. And this is not something that I've just made up. I tested international business when I was at business school. I went to Belgium and I worked for Belgian Chemical. So I loved, when I was in Navy, I loved languages. I loved traveling. I loved foreign experiences. So I wanted to be an international businessman. I went to Belgium, worked for a Belgian chemical company. I was too early. It was very family oriented. They were stuck in their ways. You couldn't get anything done. I was too early. 1960s was too early for international business. So the next summer, in order to, I couldn't go to, you know, a developed country. I'd go to a developing country and use my great capability of overcoming, you know, becoming. So I went down to Nicaragua. I was actually fluent in Spanish at the time and worked to create a They're called the Negocios Business School in Nicaragua. And I spent 4 months down there and I realized that so much, you know, small market, highly, you know, a lot of graft, a lot of fraud wasn't for me. I was too early. And thank God I rejected that because I could have spent 5 or 10 years international business long before it was became important. So that's the kind of thing I want to do. Now, it's not going to happen for everybody. If I can capture 20, 30, 40% of kids that think about it, that'll make me very happy. Also, kids make the decision not to go to college. That's one of my other crusades. I'm working with the Keys Community College down here and in Nantucket, where we give scholarships to kids that want to be plumbers, electricians, HVAC, you know, nurses, marine engineers, professional education. I'm taking the word vocation and I'm throwing it out and putting in professional. When you're a nurse, you're in a professional. When you're a marine engineer, you're in a profession. When you're a policeman or a public safety worker, you're a professional. So I've started a struggle because I think that's a really important decision. That some of the happiest people in the world come into your house, fix your plumbing, you know, charge you a lot of money and live happily ever after. And won't be, those guys won't be replaced, or the gals won't be replaced with AI either. You know?
Certainly not yet, no. Well, and the idea of exploring your passions, especially, we'll start there, especially since that is the first P in the book, that is the first chapter. Again, trying to, when we're exploring those things, especially for people who, you know, feel like they don't have a lot of resources, people who feel like they are, again, like under duress to make one of these decisions. They feel like they don't have the time or energy or whatever to really be able to spend that time exploring. You talked about, like, you know, one of the reasons that you encourage grad school is because it gives you those summer. It gives you, there is some way that it, like, literally buys you some extra time to do that. So when we are, can you talk about trying to figure out ways and avenues that we have to carve that time out to explore our passions, even if we're worried about other things?
Well, you know, some of the courses you take in college, in case my case, my engineering, half my engineering courses were a waste of time because within 3 to 5 years, everything was changed. It taught me how to think and how to work and how to attack problems. But the actual substance of the courses, or using a slide rule, for example, you probably don't even know what a slide rule is. But I saw, I became a wizard in a slide rule. 3 years later, they had something called a computer. It was basically, I threw it, put it in the drawer. So I'd like to spend some of that time thinking about me as a person. Who am I? For example, one of the things I want to attack in that passions is, first of all, recognize that for your first 16 or 18 years, you're a combination of your genes and your environment, neither of which you have control over. So who you are, you have no control over. Somewhere you wake up in your late teens and you say, wait a second, this is who, and I want to formally think about that. And then, you know, the old man's a lawyer and the mother's a teacher, or the old man's a drunk and the mother's what, you know, so it has a different effect on you. So you end up with a personality and say to yourself, this is some of the things I really want to keep of who I am. These are some of the things I really want to eliminate or at least decrease. And these are things I want to add over the next X number of years. And again, that's sort of sounds formal, but it really says, you know, some of the things in my life I really want to get. You know, I gained a lot from being an orphan and living in foster homes. But one of the things I carried away was anger. I was angry and I had to get rid of that. It's part of my, I recognize that was part of my personality I had to get rid of. So these are the kinds of things I want people to start thinking about. And when you sit in a room with 8 or 10 of your compatriots and they start talking, you start to realize you're not alone. I want the kid, the student to go home at Christmas time, either in high school or in college or after just taking part of this course, and say to his parents or whoever's in charge, you know, they've taught me how to make a living. They're teaching me how to make a living. They're also teaching me how to make a life. And I think that's a little bit squishy, you know, it's a little fuzzy, but it's the kind of thing that 20 or 30 or 40% of kids may be benefited by.
Yeah, squishy is a good word too. And I think that it outlines why it's helpful to have a guide or a teacher on that journey, because it's difficult to do this with just, you know, your compatriots. Just, you know, why is it that we think that it's a little bit squishy, a little bit hokey to earnestly have a discussion about what we believe and the kind of people we want to be, right? Like, that's something that is almost, it's almost embarrassing, people find it, to actually be earnest and talk about that.
I've exposed about 20 institutions. Not one of them said, we're not interested. Every one of them from Exeter, saw a trustee at Exeter the other day. And the schools that are put in place, immediately it becomes a, you know, a very, one of the schools, 115 students, and they're sold out. I mean, but again, I'm still early in the process because I've given these people a template, which is a skeleton. They have to basically hang on that skeleton the requirements of their unique population.
And so, again, we mentioned the first chapter is about passions. And I know at the beginning of that chapter, it talks a lot about how for most of us, it takes a lot of time and a lot of digging to uncover those important passions. And many you'll just discover later on in your life. I think about growing up being, again, talking about trying to discover our own journeys of what our own passions are, being very jealous of those people who are 7 years old and are like, I want to study birds. And then they study birds for the rest of their life. I can't connect with that at all. But God bless those people. But yeah, a lot of us, you'll feel that anxiety to really figure things out. And it's difficult to unlock the time to really earnestly, figure out what our passions were going to be. And I love what one of the passages in the book talks about. Just think about the activities that make time go quickly, I think is fun. Because it's a little bit different than just, what's something that you enjoy or what's something you think you're good at. What makes time go by quickly? It almost makes it out of your control a little bit, right?
That's it. You come in with, I used to love to go to work in the morning on Wall Street. I just couldn't wait for the next problem to come or next idea or thought process. It was, and a day would fly by. I'd arrive at the office and have my breakfast and I'd be ready to go home. It was unbelievable, And still, there's like this. I mean, I'll go through an hour with you and I'll not even know the hour passed because I'm passionate about this now. And again, you just said something very important. Passions change. They change. And you got to keep track of them.
And it's almost a little bit scary. If you find a new one, you're like, this is great. But also, how am I going to fit this in to everything else? How am I going to make the time for it?
You have to change. In your life, you're going to have to change because things will force you to change because things are changing so rapidly. You'll find out some of your business. Well, look at the guys wearing black records and then they went to cassettes and they went to discs, and now it's on a phone. You got to keep changing it. But you're in a business or in
the poor 8-track manufacturers.
Exactly right. No, it's so. I mean, that's why I think that the idea of graduating with a life design, which has parts to it, you can just go back and erase and scribble and put in new things. It's like this fits better, And there's so many activities now. Anything you name has a huge continuum in it, You don't have to be a scientist to be involved in Alzheimer's today. There's a whole bunch of other things you can do in Alzheimer's rather than being a scientist. So the same thing in AI. AI is going to have a whole spread of things to do, or nanoscience, or whatever there is. All these things have big spreads. And so you can say, this is something I'm really interested in, but I'm not a scientist, but I can take this part of it. So I think that's why I want the vocabulary to start to establish where you have the ability to just increase your capability of making the decision a little bit better and a little faster. It's not perfect because nothing's perfect.
Yeah. One of the parts of that chapter that really connected with me is that you talk about how our passion or our talents don't necessarily match our passions all the time, right? People think about that a lot of times from like the arts, like you want to, be a guitar player or whatever, you might not have the acumen for it. But the part of it that I really appreciated was that not just our talents don't necessarily match our passions, but our communities may not reward our specific passions. And I think the community part about that is critical because I think sometimes when you have a talent that matches a passion, again, say for like music or some kind of art, the amount of people that will come out of the woodwork to tell you good luck getting a job with that or something to that effect is wild. And, obviously, like on some level, those people are trying to give you some practical like financial advice or whatever. But there's also it's almost framed as like a moral failing too. Like, why would you pick something so, frivolous or impractical? But framing it, this is not a moral thing. This is just something that the community might not reward for various reasons that are outside of your control, really.
Well, you get to two points there. One is delayed gratification. Is this something I got to put away for a while, earn a bunch of money, and then I can go back to it? That's one way to do it. Or you say, this is a life I'm going into, and I'm never going to, have a lot of physical things, but I will live happily ever after. I mean, you know, if you're a painter, you can live in a, you know, and also you can change your geography. If you decide that you want to do something that's, you know, not rewarded by the community, change the community. Find a smaller place, a smaller town where you can pursue what you want to pursue and earn enough money to stay, you know, comfortable. You may have to delay gratification. I mean, even in my lifetime, I wanted to run a company. Management was my game plan. I really, at college, putting people together to create a humor magazine taught me that's what I want to do with my life. And helping people do better than they thought they could was my passion. And as a, so I busted out when I was in early 30s, started a company, spun myself out, and I failed. And I failed, earlier failure was a gift. And that, so I went back to learning the parts of the business which allow me to run a company. And I spent the next 10 years learning sales, trading, research. And then when I was 47, I got a chance to be the managing director of a firm, but I had all the capabilities. So I delayed the gratification to exercise my passion. It's a little bit complicated in my case, but that's exactly that. I was ready. And, you know, for the next 14 to 20 years, I did extremely well because I was fully qualified. I delayed, you know, really my satisfaction of running a company, and I learned all the parts of the business.
I've got one last point on the passions piece before we move on, which, again, is something that I think that we've touched on a couple times in the conversation already, which is whether it's something like delayed gratification or whether it's just, you know, deciding to make a strategic decision to follow a skill or a strength and not a passion, that you always really do have to be aware and acknowledge that you're going to have – that means giving something up.
Here's the conditions of exercising that passion, you know?
And we have to be honest about that. There is something that you have to give up.
Not all the time. I mean, if you're lucky enough, you're like Tiger Woods, you know, and you have to be talented and you start early enough, you make it. You know, that's a possibility. But, you know, each passion, though, has conditions attached to it. And, you know, a surgeon friend of mine wanted to exercise his passion. He was a professional in curvature of the spine. He could have gone to any hospital in the United States. But his passion was truly helping, you know, that people that are, you know, not in good shape. So he went to Ethiopia and he went to the Mother Teresa Center there and he opened his business. He was one of two people in Africa that did what he did. Over his lifetime, you know, he doesn't have a lot of material wealth, but he's changed and helped and saved so many lives. You see his brochure and he's a happy man. You know, it's like the idea of choosing between a small business and a large business. In a large company, you have lots of resources. You can do lots of great stuff. A small company, you get enormous responsibility. And I made that decision early on. One of my, we'll get to it, principles was freedom. I wanted freedom. And you don't get freedom in a large company. Large company, you have all the structure you have to deal with all the time. In a smaller company, they give you responsibility, you do your thing. And it's a really different activity.
Let's move on to what we just mentioned, the second P, which is principles. And you know, you talked about how, you know, what you just mentioned about freedom, and the main character in the book's guide shares a few of, you know, their principles that they live by. And one of them is this idea of seeking freedom to make your own decisions. And I thought that just the phrasing of that is really interesting. Seek freedom. And I'm curious for you, you know, I think that you talk about later on in the book about yourself that that's, you know, kind of one of your core principles too is seeking freedom. Can you talk just about what that means to you to seek freedom in your decision making?
Well, is it when you get a job offer and you look at exactly how much responsibility you have and how much you can do without asking for permission. You know, I had a choice when I got out of business school, become an investment banker, and back in 1964, you spent 4 to 8 years in the dungeon following some important person around learning the business. All right. That was in the financial area. This is an investment banker. That was supposed to be an eagle. And I went out to California by mistake. In the book, you'll see this. And I met a company who was in the mutual fund business and they want to make me an analyst. And, you know, I went back to Wall Street and I said to the guy, you know, I think I'm going to become an analyst. He says, analysts are gophers. Bankers are eagles. And this eagle sits in this, you know, room with no windows and carry somebody's bag around for 4 to 8 years. And this analyst, they told me, in 3 months, I'll be out on the road with my briefcase calling on companies. So the freedom decision was easy. these people are offering me freedom. This guy here is going to incarcerate me for 4 to 8 years. Now, if I made it through, it's almost a guaranteed very successful life. And, you know, the kinds of people who become partners of major firms in those days became extremely successful, you know, financially. But here I had freedom, you know. And of course, even that was not enough freedom for me. After being with this company for 3 years, I said to the boss, I really want my own division, my own company. So they spun me off. I own 3%, they own 70%. I was forcing what I should not have forced. I should have learned more, you know, but I failed for 3 or 4 years later. There's a lot of in the book, it wasn't all my fault, but that was, you know, I did fail, but it was something I really kept pressing. And even when I took jobs on Wall Street, I wanted, like for my EF Hutton job, I said, this is what I want. I want you to give me these three parts of the business and I'll run them. So that was the kind of thing. It's, and in a sense, also getting freedom in almost everything you do or try to do, that's very important. Where I wouldn't want someone to set my hours, for example, or my vacations. So I took jobs where they said to me, you can work as long as you want and take as much time off as you want. So the freedom was in one of my elements, and I finally got there. And when I was 47 years old, I became the managing partner of a firm. And I then exercised my passions, put my principles into place, hired my partners, and did my plans. I got it all together. It took me 20 years out of business school, and I had failed once. One of my principles is early failure is a gift because you learn so much from it. And I did learn quite a bit from that. But freedom was very, very important. Now, it's a continuum. Nobody is totally free.
There's another moment in that chapter where the main character has just spent, you know, hours or days exploring, you know, philosophy and religion, all these things about trying to nail down his principles, the things that he really believes in. And he finishes up all the exhausting work and then just, you know, goes outside and kind of finds a spot under a tree to sit down and let his mind wander. And it feels like, I feel like those are moments for me that I feel the most in touch with, like, my principles and the things I believe, is when you step back. And a lot of times it is literally like outside in nature for me. That can be anything for any number of people. I was curious about that part for you, if that's something that just that stepping back away from all of the intense study that we think is the identifying and pursuing and trying to figure things out. But the stepping back is where we can have maybe a little bit more clarity. And for me, that's definitely like literally under a tree, like Marcus says in the book.
No, the studies have shown that the concept of being out in nature allows you to assimilate and digest, you know, very complicated concepts. And that's why, you know, this huge array of different ideas that this poor person is exposed to is exactly what happens to us. You know, now in my case, I was brought up in a Catholic environment, and do unto others, you know, the golden rule was communicated to me with the golden ruler, you know, and they also said, if you do the right things, you end up in this nice place. And if you do the wrong things, you end up in the other place. So that was ingrained. But again, taking all that, and of course, I was in a Jewish orphanage, which totally changed everything again. So by the time I got to college, I had to sit in under that tree and absorb this and decide from there, where was I going to go? I was lucky enough to take the good principles from both and carry them through my life. And you know, those are the kinds of things you absorb. And that's why this array in that second chapter, you're going to have to pick out. You can't do them all. You have to pick out half a dozen things which you're going to have as your principle. And recognize, just like passions, principles change throughout your lifetime. You add principles sometimes, and certainly circumstances allow you to do certain things. You put certain principles in place that allow you to carry out things a certain way. Let me just tell you about Wall Street. I had a mantra, and my mantra in Wall Street was to live happy, was to live hidden. Because I believed after failing that I couldn't do two things. I couldn't be a public persona and run a company. And I really wanted to run the company. So when I got called for television or radio or magazines or newspapers, wouldn't do that. So I would live happy, was live hidden. Now, at my age, and I've shifted, and I wrote, by the way, I wrote this, started writing these books in my 70s. I buried my background for 70 years. I didn't want to tell it. I wanted to live happy, to live hidden. But now that I've decided taking this next step, this next passion requires me to be a public figure. It scares me to death. But I had to abandon that principle. Philip Happy's the hidden. I'm not hidden. I'm actually on LinkedIn now, which I never was before, which I should have been. I'm on Instagram. I haven't gone on TikTok yet, but my publicist is pushing me to do it because this is a communication. So these principles change. And also, as a young man, I was angry. Now I'm grateful. That principle changed quite a bit. And then the real principle that helped me out was somewhere in my mid-career, I decided to start to deflect credit. Peter says to me, you did a great job, Ed. I said, Peter, thank you very much. But it really was Mary Jo and Jose. You get a trifecta right away. You feel good. Peter says, this guy's a really good guy. And when Mary Jo and Jose find out, they feel good. And by the way, nobody ever does anything alone. And I think deflecting credit, you know, it's a really an interesting aspect to life. You know, and I've tried to do that, you know, more and more. Always say thank you. That there are two most important words, thank you, and the other one is, we'll come to this, I'm sure, what's next, which I think is something that everybody has to continue to do. And we'll spend some time on that because one of my real principles is never be a victim. And so always focus on what's next. Take the energy in being a victim and focus on what's next. It's a really key principle in life. It can be angry for a day or two, a week, but get out of that because it does no good whatsoever. And I have living proof of fact that taking my energies and placing what's next allowed me to be successful.
I want to move on really quick to partners, just so I make sure that we cover everything in the hour that we've got. And we've talked a little bit about already that it's difficult to find partners that align with your principles and your passions, period, let alone those who can also do things that you can't do. And one of the things that you talk about, which I think people struggle with so much, is, you know, finding those partners. You can request certain kinds of guidance. You can ask people to be partners, which I think really scares the hell out of a lot of people, is asking for help.
Yeah. Well, that's what, in my area, you didn't ask for help. If you asked for help, we're not going to stay away from this fellow. But, you know, the most important was P1. And, you know, you got to recognize there's no such thing as a perfect partnership. And when my son-in-law asked for to marry my daughter, I said to him, you got to have four things. You got to love my daughter. That's totally an emotional experience. Don't even think about it. You got to love her to some great extent. Second of all, you might be committed. That's an intellectual decision. I'm committed to this relationship. Then third of all, you're going to have to compromise. I mean, you two are going to have to come together and decide certain things that you're both going to agree, you come halfway. And then finally, I said to him, one of the key things in a relationship is sacrifice. Somewhere along the line, you're going to have to sacrifice, do something you really don't want to do. And she will have to do the same thing. And you may have to do it a couple, three times before it's her turn, you know, because should she happen to be the breadwinner. So these are the kinds of things you have to go through. But finding that kind of partner, first of all. Now the partner in business is the other partner I was talking about, doing things you can't do and things like that. But finding in business, and every opportunity is different. When I was the chairman of the board of trustees at the University of Rochester, the kind of partners I needed were totally different than the kind of partners I needed at Lehman Brothers or Furman Sells or in Wall Street. And you had to bring those partners together. And also, you know, what I call the other, besides P1, finding a friend. You know, when I give graduation speeches, I said, look to the right, find someone you'd like to spend the rest of your life with that you're going to cultivate and communicate with every year. Because having someone who's interested in you and you're interested in them really helps an awful lot. But, you know, if you have a real friend, I had one at Rochester that took me home when I had no place to go. We were chemical engineers together, Navy together. And he was the guy that convinced me to go to Harvard. I was working. He said, you have to come up here. This is someplace where you, because he knew me really well. He said, you have to be here. So I went up there and did change my life. We spent the life together. And when he was dying 10 years ago, you know, I would call him up and he would say, how are you? How is Barbara? Are you working too hard? He was worried about me and he was dying. So that's the kind of friend you want to have. If you get him. And by the way, it took a lifetime. We worked together. You know, I was with him when he first got, I was in his wedding, you know, the whole thing. And you need one or two of those in your life. And then you really made it, having lost him. You know, I've never really been able to replace him. But that's a long answer, short question.
There's a concept that you talk about in that chapter too that's called the law of altitude. Can you explain that for us really quick?
Well, in all of these, in partners, you have to sort of, you know, climb up each of the walls. is you have a partner for self and a partner for family, a partner for work, and a partner for giving back. And you know, you can only climb one of those mounts at a time. And when you get to a certain altitude, you require different partners. In certain cases, when you get to too high a place, you need partners that don't exist. And that's, you know, they got to worry about that. You get way up there and in a particular part of your life, and you know, you're all alone. And, you know, I find that a couple times in my life running a company. And then you have to seek out what I call groups of partners. There are, like, I'm a member of Young Presidents Organization, YPO. We used to meet once a month. All the guys were presidents. We're all essentially alone. We're at the top of the pile. There's nobody we can really talk to. But here was a place we could talk. And not only talk about business, talk about family. We still meet 40 years later. I'm still meeting these guys, not once a month now, kind of a couple times a year. But altitude is each one of these parts of your life, sort of, you have to climb up the wall and you need people to help you get up that ladder. And at certain points, there are very few partners up there. On the way up, you need the right kind of partners there.
The last of the four P's is plans. And we talk about how even imperfect plans can help. But one of the things that we've been returning to in this conversation is about change, right? You talked about that being one of the very few constants in life. When we're making plans and we have to account for change, how do we start to get a little bit more comfortable with change as it's something that we're going to have to deal with in our plans?
Well, see, in other words, that's why the first book is the first part of the planning chapter goes into something called the exploratorium. You get into this big column and you can take on geography, government, economics, history. And you can study it. So then you say, all right, change is increasing, needless to say, but look in the past. There have been change. Here's how people have coped with change. You know, the people that were riding in horses and, you know, making buggy whips decided they'd make something called a car. And then we look at the computer, now internet, and now AI and so forth. So just accept the fact there's going to be change, and young people have to accept the change is going to be a little more rapid than it has been in the past. But when you go through this exploratorium, you find out there are drivers of change. Technology is one of them. Geography is one of them. I mean, let's talk about geography. You know, my son went to Denver in the late 80s, early 90s, and went into real estate, became an architect. It's been a very good ride. Or someone, in my case, I left the business school and I was one of two people who went into the mutual fund industry, which everybody poo-pooed. Of course, it was the fastest growing industry for the next 20, 25 years. It's still a very large business. You know, so you have to pick out that whole process and recognize, you know, again, what you want to play in also. You know, what are the characteristics of the plan you're trying to do? Now, when you go for the exploratorium, you take all this stuff, and you go to the next little cottage, which is the matrix, and you start to mix it together. You mix it together with your passions and your principles, and that's what you're doing basically right now anyway. You know, this is just a fable that allows you to think about what you're doing. Because you're really doing that. That's how people make decisions. They look at the future, at least I hope they do. And they take their passions and principles and say, how am I going to marry my passions and my principles, my context to these kinds of trends? And they don't come out as overtly as they should. You should really write them down. Say, this is what I think is going to happen, you know, and here's how I'm going to take advantage of it. Now, as I get into it, it's not happening, then I can stop and think about it. And I recommend every year end, you take a short dive into what you're doing. And every 3 years, you go away someplace and spend a week writing down and thinking about what you've done, where you're going, and how it's going. And don't be afraid then to make, then you'll be, have a better process of changing. These sort of mechanical experiences are so important. You know, every Christmas we would go away on a boat and the kids would sit down and analyze what they did for the year, where they're going and so forth. And, you know, they were able to make decisions. I mean, and some of the decisions were good and some weren't so good, but at least we thought about them. And I think you had a better chance of doing it. Plus, as I say, the game is getting more complex and changes are occurring quicker. And you'll if you deal with yourself once a year, seriously, you can pick up some things that, you know, not working. Like at Lehman Brothers, I finally realized just this is a guy I couldn't work for and I had to leave. I mean, I was a partner and make a lot of money and everything else, but I couldn't spend time with this. The 7 years was too long. I mean, I just couldn't handle it, so I left. But I did it actually, it was a Christmas. I went on walking on the beach down in the Caribbean, and I said to myself, and I wrote down exactly that. I checked off some things that told me what was going on, and I said, now's the time to change. Not easy. Nothing's easy.
No. You know, one of the things that we bring up in this plans chapter, but also is mentioned in a couple other chapters too, is this idea of enough. Finding out for you and deciding what's enough. What's enough money? What's enough achievement? What's enough happiness for you? And I was thinking about, again, my own experience, and that's been something that as an adult, I've had to really reckon with and intellectualize in a way that I just had no idea was going to be something that I needed to do. It wasn't something that had been spelled out as the, you know, in the process of going through school and in teenage years and everything. But what's enough has really been, and again, this is all talking about, you know, harmony between these four things. Enough is a part of that, right? Like, you're going to have to sacrifice.
It's one of the things. Most important parts, you know.
Yeah.
You know, as you choose something, you know, again, financial is not easy for me to talk about. You know, just enough finances to do what you want to do. You know, you have just enough. People have just enough money. All through life, I found people stopping. And even me, I was obviously, my just enough, I was going to be financially secure. But at age 47, cashing in Lehman Brothers, going to Furman Sales, I had just enough money to take me to the next step. It turned out to be, it worked out really well, but it may not have. But I was going to a place where I had just enough money, you know, and I think just enough fame is another thing. People get soaked into, you know, constantly want to drink ink. They want to see their face on, you know, on places, and that go, you can just too much of that. And you find out those will crash and burn. Those are obvious all over the place. So just having the concept of just enough in your head, I think is a very important thing right across the board, whatever it is. And so you can stop. You can stop or slow down. Like I've actually stopped now. I have just enough financial resources to do anything I want to do. So I'm not interested anymore. I mean, I do still invest in the stock market because it's an intellectual video game that keeps me interested, keeping my mind going. But, you know, when I used to lose money, I would, you know, annoyed and everything. It is what it is, you know, not because I've gotten to a point where I really have enough. But what I really don't have enough of is the satisfaction of giving back. And I found something, I think, where, you know, there's a statement which, you know, what we old people live for is that, you know we're not going to live forever. Let's try to make some things that do.
Ed, we only have a couple more minutes left. So one of the things I want to finish us off on, I want to ask you a question that we ask every guest on the show. And, you know, this book is obviously, you know, partially about guides and about teachers and about how some of the best teachers and guides we have in our lives are teaching us how to be our own guides and do these things for ourselves. And so I want to ask about just the, you know, the mentors, teachers, guides you've had in your life who have helped you become who you are today.
You hit on a vital. My father was a decent guide. I mean, but he was never there. He was a radio operator aboard a ship. We spent very little time together my first 18 years. And then later on in life, he disagreed with almost everything I did because, you know, he wanted me to stay in the service because he was successful in the service. I didn't stay in the service. And we had a falling out. It was peaceable coexistence. But all through my life, I had luckily had mentors. And at first I just had them. And then I sought them out. The senior person at the second orphanage was a wonderful man, and he convinced me, I was already pushing towards it, to go to a private college, and he gave me a small scholarship when I left, so he was good. My freshman year, the mechanical drawing professor, I was terrible. I couldn't draw a straight line with Ruby. He helped me out, and for the 4 years, he was my mentor. We did everything together. I was in activities with him and so on and so forth. And then, of course, on Wall Street, I came to the conclusion, which is there are no heroes. I don't have heroes. I take people and say, what are the best traits that person has? I'd like to have that trait. Because people will always disappoint you because we're all packages. You know, we have good things and bad things. But if you grab from those people. So I grabbed mentorship from different people. One person, though, I did end up being a person that I felt was a lifelong mentor, a guy named Wally, who was 10 years older than I was and had gone a very successful business on Wall Street. And whenever I made a decision, I'd always check with Wally and say, Wally, what do you think? And sometimes he gave me good advice, most of the time, actually. But other times he couldn't answer the questions. But I feel having mentors and seeking them out all through life is worthwhile. I have, I guess, maybe 10 or 12 people who call me regularly and ask me questions with some emotions I can't answer, but, you know, who consider me a mentor. We've proven this completely with studies in high schools and colleges. Having a mentor is so important. There's a group in Boston called Wiley, and I'm an honorary director of it. They provide, if you go to MIT, you're in a scholarship student, you can sign up with Wiley, and they basically, you have to talk to your counselor once a week, because they found conclusively, kids don't flunk out academically, they flunk out socially. And of course, Wiley became vital during COVID, because these were all foster kids, and they had no place to go. And Wiley took care of placing them, so forth. So to answer your question, yes, I've had mentors all my life, and I gave you the head of the orphanage, the freshman, my freshman year at college, Navy, I had a number of models that were, you know, was wonderful captains of ships. And one executive officer who wrote me a wonderful letter for Harvard was a perfect human being just to keep track of. And he was, you know, smart, you know, sensitive, you know, he knew how to handle a lot of things I learned from him and so forth. So,
well, Ed, it's been an hour. I don't want to take up your whole day, but thank you again for taking all the time to have this conversation.
Thank you for reading the book. I love when someone goes in and gets the passengers out and gets something out of it. You've made my day, so thank you.
Thank you, Ed. That was my conversation with Ed Hagem. Thanks so much for listening to Teacher's Lounge. As always, feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. You can send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu. And wherever you're hearing the podcast, subscribe, leave us a rating, share it with a friend. Whatever you're able to do, it really is the best way to get even more perspectives on the show. You can subscribe to our newsletter to keep up to date with everything we've got going on with the show over at wnij.org. A big thanks to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear each and every episode of the show. And I've been your host, Peter Mudlin, and we'll be back with more Teacher's Lounge very soon. See ya.